Chapter 36. November 13th of year 18. Instead of repairing the damage to Messenger, the fabricators have been busy since the day before yesterday building a break for Fred, as we have come to call the 200-meter asteroid at Eve's suggestion. Fred is heavy and hard to slow down, and it is our plan to let it collide with a few smaller asteroids. This would reduce its momentum and simultaneously increase its mass somewhat. The heavier the asteroid gets, the slower it will become. Afterward, we adjust our velocity so that we are in Fred's slipstream, while it gradually moves inward through the asteroid belt. The plan sounds more complicated than it is in reality, because our speed and that of the components of the asteroid belt do not differ much. So basically, we just need to change our direction. Some sensor units built by the fabricators are already on their way to the smaller rocks we want to use in order to slow down the large one. The units possess a weak engine that can be used to move the mini-asteroids in the direction of Fred. It is impossible to accurately predict how it will all end. According to predictions, we will need between 19 and 28 days to cross the asteroid field, and the risk of being hit during this time is close to zero. That does not look too bad. I have survived much worse odds, for instance during my journey through the Enceladus Ocean. Yesterday I tried to tell Adam and Eve about that adventure, but they politely declined. I understand that Earth's solar system means very little to them, as do the stories told by an old man. The automatic system announces, "Course correction in 3, 2, 1. The thrusters at starboard start firing, and once again I place myself at the tip of Messenger to be able to better follow everything. The spaceship is performing a slow turn, and a sound alerts me to the fact that something important is happening behind me. The first rock has drilled itself into Fred's surface. Excellent aim, I think. The impact did not cause any material to splinter. Therefore, this inelastic collision provided an optimal braking effect. Not all of the collisions triggered by us will work so neatly. 4,330 meters, 5.5 meters per second, the automatic system reports half an hour later, indicating our distance to Fred and our relative speed. Our protective shield is still a bit too fast. In this brief time, we cannot sufficiently slow Messenger down with thrusters alone, so we need Fred to follow our plan. However, there is only one smaller rock left to feed to Fred. The rest is small stuff that will not have much effect on the 200-meter boulder. For safety's sake, we also prepared a plan B. It was Eve's idea, and right now I am very grateful to her for it, even though I assigned Adam to execute the plan. Adam is already wearing his spacesuit. It is a brand new model, which was introduced on Earth just 6 months before our launch. Instead of a hard lower part that holds the pressure of the gas around the human body at half an atmosphere, it consists of a skin-tight, flexible material. Only the head is protected by the classic helmet with a transparent visor. The creator must have illegally copied the design from NASA, since the company that manufactured the suit had patented it. If we really need Plan B, this will be Adam's first spacewalk. Therefore, I would prefer to find a different way. But it does not look like there is one. Right now, the sensors are reporting that the last rock sent to slow Fred only grazed it. Our protective shield has started to tumble a little, which further complicates Plan B. It could not be helped. "Adam, it's your turn," I say. "I'm finally getting out of here," he says confidently, trying to sound cool, but his biomonitor indicates an enormously accelerated heartbeat. I hope he won't keel over. From my position at the tip of the spaceship, I see a hatch opening on the backside of Messenger. Until now, it had been invisible. Two hands appear at the edge of the hatch, and then a person pulls himself out. I am scared seeing Adam like this. He almost looks unprotected in the tight-fitting spacesuit, and his head seems larger and more vulnerable than usual.
"Wow," he calls out. "That's really high. I mean, deep."
"Look for a fixed point of reference and check whether your line is attached," I remind Adam. Of course, Adam knows what to do.
but clear instructions are useful in all this excitement. "Do you have a horizon? That is your plane," I tell him. "You should mentally adapt to it. Now look around carefully. You should be able to see Fred quite well from where you are. I'm activating your tracer." Now an arrow appears on the inside of Adam's helmet, showing him the direction. I forgot that Adam's senses would have a hard time seeing Fred, since it is gray against a black background.
"Got it,"
he says. "It is 300 meters distant, and your differential speed is 3 meters per second," I say.
"So we'll be here in 100 seconds?
"Yes, that's enough time. Now take the harpoon." I see Adam reaching into the hatch and taking out a pole with a length of 2 meters. At its tip, there is an explosive charge meant to drive the harpoon into Fred. On the other end, a thin but very strong monofilament line is attached. We are going to harpoon Fred, and will consequently be dragged along by it. This way we can also equalize the speed difference. Adam just has to hit the asteroid at the right moment. There I become aware of a slight problem, caused by the grazing impact a while ago. Fred is rotating slowly. In a worst-case scenario, it will retain the rotation and slowly drag Messenger around itself. If we are unlucky, Fred won't shield us, but we would shield the asteroid. Fred is a clever guy, but this would also mean our end.
"Watch out, Adam," I warn him. 90 meters, 30 seconds.
Adam's heartbeat is surprisingly calm again. The boy obviously can focus well.
30 meters, countdown.
A computerized voice begins counting backward from 10. At the count of 0, Adam jumps in our direction of travel, holding the harpoon far in front of him. This maneuver is calculated to give Adam a slight head start over Fred.
"Approaching target," Adam says. "Contact in 3, 2, 1, 0.
I involuntarily expect a sound, but the charge detonates in complete silence. The harpoon enters deep into Fred's surface. At least, that is what it looks like as seen from the spaceship.
"Line pressure within the tolerance range," Adam reports.
The line connecting the harpoon and the spaceship is briefly subjected to enormous pressure, but it does not appear to be damaged. What about the asteroid's rotation, I wonder?
"Line is taut, registering vertical course component," Adam says.
Fred is rotating at only half the speed, but it is rotating, and therefore pulling Messenger closer. The spaceship must not get too close to it.
"Adam, return to the ship," I order.
I can see Adam hesitate. He receives the same messages as I do, and understands that something is wrong.
"Come back. You can't do anything about it," I tell him. "We have to wait and see."
Adam lets his own line pull him back to the hatch, but he does not enter the ship.
"We can't just wait," he says.
Adam reaches into the hatch and picks up the backup harpoon made by the fabricators in case the first one failed. He slowly stands up and turns around his axis. He is looking for something. Then he jumps off. Now I realize what he is looking for. The other end of Fred.
"Force and counterforce," I remind myself.
When he is close enough to the asteroid, he pushes the harpoon into the rock and the charge detonates. If we are lucky, this will compensate for the rotation, at least so much that the control jets of Messenger have a chance of overcoming it. Couldn't fate let us be lucky, at least for once?
"Rotation almost 0,
the automatic system reports.
"Adam has done it."
"Great work," I say. But Adam does not answer. Now I realize why. His line has wrapped itself around the line of the second harpoon. A stupid accident. The motor inside the hatch pulls on it, making everything worse. I see Adam frantically trying to cut the line of the harpoon.
"Adam, stop," I say. "It's the wrong line. That's monofilament, so you've got no chance."
I feel a shiver run down my spine. I have to recommend something absolutely forbidden to Adam.
"Cut your own line," I insist.
Adam pauses for a moment. He can hardly believe it. "Never without a safety line,"
That is the ironclad rule. But he does not hesitate long and starts sawing on his own line.
Hold on to the harpoon line with your feet, like a trapeze artist, I instruct him. Otherwise, you will fly off once the line is cut.
I don't know whether Adam ever saw an image of trapeze artists, yet he hooks his feet around the line.
I made it, he says.
I see an end of the line swinging sideways.
Now carefully pull yourself toward the hatch, I say. Always have one hand on the line. Never let go with both. It is only 5 meters. You've got time, I want to say.
But then something beeps frantically inside my head.
Collision warning,
the automated system reports.
Govno, I exclaim. Shit!
A small asteroid is approaching from ahead. It is not clear whether it will hit Adam, but it would be extremely dangerous if it collides with the line the boy is holding on to.
Adam, go! You have 3 seconds. Now!
Perhaps it is the panic in my voice. Perhaps Adam can really react this fast. But he abandons any precaution and pulls himself with both arms and full force toward the hatch. I cannot hear him breathing. He is probably holding his breath due to the effort.
All clear,
the automatic system reports the moment Adam reaches the hatch. He utters a long sigh.
Congratulations. That was fantastic, I say.
Adam drops down without a word, and the hatch closes behind him.
That was my first and last spacewalk. Who came up with the stupid term anyway?
I am proud of my son.